Good morning, friends. It is time for Friday with Jim, and I'm your host, Jim Wilkins. Kate Brister is engineering for us today. And this show was conceived by Lisa Smith, and we're carrying on her tradition. And I'm fortunate to have with me today as a guest, Chris Smith, and we're going to talk about forests. Hey, Chris, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate the opportunity.
I wonder, to get started here, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. I work for an organization called the North Coast State Forest Coalition, and we are a coalition of nonprofit organizations based in Northwest Oregon, and we advocate for balanced management of state forest lands, particularly the Tillamook and Clatsop State Forests up here on the North Coast. And we see these forests as critical to maintaining a number of values for Oregonians, including fish and wildlife habitat, recreation, clean drinking water, and also a sustainable timber enterprise for the North Coast economy.
And so what exactly do you do in your job?
Oh, I do a little bit of everything. I'm a community organizer, first and foremost, and I also manage a lot of volunteers. We take people out into the forest to show them kind of special features of the Tillamook and Clatsop. We have a bunch of newsletters. We have kind of a constant stream of educational events and advocacy opportunities, and oftentimes you'll find me in front of the Board of Forestry testifying as to how they should manage the Tillamook and Clatsop.
Right. Now, maybe you could speak a little bit about the history of these forests. I know that initially, before the white man came here, obviously we just had trees and stuff. But then what happened?
Well, in the late 19th century, starting in the mid-19th century and through about the 1920s, the North Coast forests were logged very aggressively. Private timber companies came in, and it was a little bit of a free-for-all, and took a lot of logs off the forest. And in the 30s and 40s, that logging combined with some catastrophic fires that are collectively called the Tillamook Burn left the majority of these lands pretty much devoid of any value in terms of economic value. And so the timber companies defaulted on their taxes because why pay taxes on something that's not producing for you? And the lands went briefly to county ownership, and the counties determined that they didn't have the bandwidth or the ability to manage the lands, and so they deeded the lands to the state. And in a series of acquisitions, the state acquired the lands, and that's how they came to be the Tillamook and Clatsop State Forests. And over the last 40 or 50 years, the forests have been, they were replanted by a massive replanting effort, and they've kind of grown back into these recovering forests, and they're now at the age where they're starting to resemble what they once were, but they're also at the age where they're very lucrative for logging.
Sure. I'm wondering whether you could take us through the cycle of you've got a denuded land, and then how did it come about, the replanting program?
Well, it was paid for by a state bond, and it was a largely volunteer effort, a lot of Boy Scouts, I believe. I think prison crews were involved, a number of kind of at-large volunteers, and I think paid reforesters as well. And I've heard stories from people who were involved in the replanting who said that the landscape basically looked like the moon with stumps on it.
Hmm.
And it was the largest forest planting effort in the history of the world.
And so now we're reaping the benefit of that replanting, is that correct?
We are, and I don't think that it was kind of a universally agreed upon choice to make, that replanting. I think some people thought it was maybe too costly, too much time, too much energy, but as we see now driving up and down the North Coast, I think it was an effort well worth it.
Now, after that happened, I mean, assuming that people didn't replant, what kind of cycle would the woods go through to regenerate naturally?
It would have been a longer cycle. It would have started from seeds, obviously, rather than kind of saplings that were pushed into the ground. And it would have been a slower growing but a more diverse and open forest, so a more complex forest ecosystem. What we have, rather than that, is kind of a human-engineered forest, which is a densely planted forest, primarily Doug fir, although there's also spruce and cedar. So a natural forest process would have resulted in kind of a multi-layered, longer transitioning forest with a very diverse set of species. And rather than that, we have not a monoculture crop, but something kind of in between what we would see as a natural forest and a tree plantation.
When you have a monoculture like that, how does that affect the nutrients in the soil?
Well, I'm not a biologist, but just like any crop, as farmers have learned for thousands and thousands of years, a diversity of planting and kind of practices of crop rotation and allowing the land to kind of fertilize itself after a harvest is critical. And so I believe we've seen slight slowdowns in growth after several processes of harvesting and planting the same species.
A slowdown in growth. How so?
Well, there's just not quite the nutrients that was in the soil historically. And part of that has to do with the process of logging and then spraying herbicide. And part of it has to do with the fact that we are seeing primarily Douglas firs, and we're not allowing to see the forest through several phases, which would see, you know, an alder underlayer and then some firs and cedars, and then eventually Sitka spruce would be the dominant species.
What's that going to look like long term?
Well, it depends how we manage the land. There are areas that are left primarily unmanaged, whether that's because they are on steep slopes or they're nearby streams or they're encumbered by species of concern, and those areas will see that natural process play out. And if those processes are allowed to play out for 50 or 100 or 200 more years, we'll see those kind of ancient forests start to return. In the areas where human touch is heavier, we're going to continue to see largely Doug fir plantations that are fairly dense and don't provide a lot of habitat value, but do provide kind of that consistent cash crop.
So now we're managing the forests almost as an agricultural entity.
Yes, and especially on the private industrial timberlands, which kind of dominate Western Oregon. That's very much what it is. It's a long, long crop compared to most agriculture, but it's you plant and it grows, and then you harvest it, and you make sure nothing else grows there, and then you plant and it grows and you harvest it. So it's very much like corn or wheat in the Midwest.
What kind of cycle?
How long?
Yes.
Private industrial lands, depending on the growth rate in Western Oregon, are harvested every 30 to 50 years.
Wow.
So it's a rapid process. And I know that people, you know, they used to see log trucks with one or two logs on them going down, you know, Highway 101 or 26. And now it's very, very small logs and a number of them. So the timber industry has done a good job of maximizing the crop that they want out of those forests.
But, you know, the forests, actually, there's more to the forest than just the trees. And we have ecosystems and recreational activities and how is that stuff managed?
On state forest land, they strive for a balance. So they're trying to get a diversity of values from the land, and that's a combination of economic and social and environmental values. And so they recognize the ecological importance of the land, the ecosystems, which are critical for salmon runs and numerous terrestrial species, clean aquatic habitat. But they also see the need to provide that consistent harvest. And so on state lands, there's a recognition of the diversity of values, and there's a real effort to overcome the challenges in meeting all of those goals. On private lands, I think the dominant value that they are trying to achieve is timber. And so while there are, in my opinion, fairly weak restrictions on private land logging, there are some restrictions that aim to protect ecological benefits, but they're weaker than other states on the West Coast, certainly.
Yeah, those restrictions that you mentioned, I'm curious, what are they and how are they enforced?
I think the most important restrictions that people think of are riparian buffers, which are, you know, set-asides on either side of streams to provide shade and cooling mechanisms for streams and ensure that there's adequate woody debris going into streams to provide habitat and nutrients for aquatic species. And then restrictions on the amount of herbicide you can spray and where you can spray it, and restrictions on how steep your slopes can be or how steep a slope you can log on. Those are some of the big ones, what kind of roads you can build. And on private land, stream buffers are very small. They're undergoing a rule change currently, but they're still inadequate in the views of most scientists. Herbicide spraying is very aggressive, and there's very little limit as to what can be sprayed and when. And steep slopes are often logged. On state forests, the buffers are wider. There's not quite as much herbicide being sprayed, although there's still plenty. And they're undergoing an effort to kind of identify best practices for road building. But we're still a long way from seeing kind of the best science driving forestry in the region. And the Department of Forestry has a branch that oversees the implementation of the Forest Practices Act. And that's the set of those rules that dictate how and when you can log and spray. And so the department is in charge of not only managing state forest lands, but also overseeing the implementation on private lands.
So do they patrol? I mean, how do they make sure that, particularly with private lands, how can we as Oregonians assure ourselves that these are being treated with respect?
You know, I think the Department of Forestry has a good and close relationship with most timber companies, and I think that that's probably both good and bad. It allows transparency for the department, probably, and there's a lot of, I think, cross-pollination of foresters who have worked for the department and work now for timber companies or vice versa. And the department does check in with, you know, private lands pretty frequently. But in terms of kind of public oversight, I don't know what there is. There's, you know, the Forest Practices Act is a complicated set of rules, and a normal citizen doesn't have a whole lot of knowledge or access to those rules. And it's difficult to see how it's implemented on the landscape. So my answer would be that the public can see kind of the outcomes and are often forced to pay for those outcomes of aggressive logging on private lands. But in terms of oversight, maybe we have a little less than we should.
Mm-hmm. And the state land board is the ultimate administrator of this, is that correct?
The Board of Forestry actually manages the lands on behalf of Oregonians. So
okay.
The Board of Forestry is appointed by the governor and confirmed by the Senate, and they're a group of citizens who oversee state forest and private forest rules in Oregon. And there's a kind of a structure of timber companies having significant influence on the board. Several of the board members are always employees of the industry. And so that's also a challenge, is ensuring that board is doing its job and fulfilling its obligations to Oregon.
But how can an average citizen participate in that and assure themselves that that's happening?
Well, a lot of citizens actually go in front of the Board of Forestry. It's mm-hmm. not uncommon at all, which is good to see. And I think the board takes them seriously. And there's public processes, especially for state forest lands, although the effectiveness of public input into those processes I'm not sure about. But the board is supposed to be responsive to the concerns of Oregonians. And so you can write letters to the board, you can go and testify to the board. But again, it's probably not as open as it ought to be.
Yeah. Well, I'd like to remind our listeners that it's Friday here at Coast Community Radio. I'm your host, Jim Wilkins, and we're visiting with Chris Smith, clearly talking about the forests in the Oregon region. Now, Chris, my understanding is that our forests here are one of the best places in the world to grow Douglas fir, as far as suitable habitat for that tree. Maybe you could talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, that's my understanding too. I'm not a forester, but I've been told by foresters that this is one of the best, if not the best, region in the world for growing forests. We have great soil, especially up here in Clatsop County, a little less so down in Tillamook County, but great soil. It's relatively flat up here in Clatsop. Again, more steep terrain down in Tillamook. And the amount of rainfall is astounding for growing trees. And the temperate climate also allows for amazing growing conditions. So we have the opportunity on the North Coast to meet a diversity of values here with the way our forests can grow. And it's obviously been a historical boon for the timber industry. And finding out how to take advantage of these amazing growing conditions for all values is kind of the challenge in front of us.
Yeah, that's kind of what I'm getting at is how does the public reach that balance as far as what's good for the timber companies and what's good long-term for the forest?
Yeah, well, I think it's important to nuance the conversation and not have a dualistic approach. I mean, logging is an integral part of the North Coast economy. It has been for, you know, over a century, and it will continue to be for the foreseeable future. But at the same time, I think Oregonians' values have changed a little bit, and our economy has developed further. And we have to see kind of the benefits of recreation and long-term forest health for broader climate issues, for fish runs, for, you know, clean drinking water as being worth protecting. And I don't think that was the view initially when logging really took hold of this region. But as those other values have kind of come to the fore, I think people have realized that we can achieve it all, but it's a matter of managing the land appropriately. And sometimes that's going to mean not taking everything we can and leaving some there for these other values. You know, the timber economy is important, and as strong as it is, it's no longer the dominant economy in Oregon. It's relatively small at this point. And so people move to Oregon or they live in Oregon because of these other things, whether it's, you know, recreating, hiking in the forest, or catching your first steelhead in the forest, or, you know, kind of just the natural aesthetic beauty of the area. And so I think we have to realize that Oregon is changing and the North Coast is changing. And in order to kind of keep up with the people's understanding of values, forest management has to progress.
Well, in Clatsop County, I'm wondering how much of the forest is privately owned as opposed to publicly owned forest?
I don't have numbers in front of me, but the bulk of it is private industrial forest. Mm-hmm. And there's almost no federal forest in Clatsop County. I think it's maybe 400 acres. It's minute. And so state forest makes up around 200,000 acres in Clatsop County, and that's kind of a rough estimate. But that's really the opportunity for balance to occur right now. And while I would love to see private management practices improve to take care of those other values, the real opportunity for conservation, serious, you know, set asides for fish and wildlife, for example, is on those state forests. And the Clatsop State Forest is, you know, it's a beautiful piece of land. It's mostly contiguous, and it's this recovering forest, and those opportunities are present on the forest, certainly.
But even in the Clatsop Forest is still being managed partially for timber production.
I would say primarily for timber production. On the forest, roughly 27% is set aside without logging. And those are, again, those stream buffers and steep slopes and areas where there are species of concern, endangered species. Another 18% is open to thinning and selective logging. And oftentimes that's fairly aggressive selective logging. And then the rest of the forest, which is over 50%, is open for clear cutting. Mm-hmm. And the Department of Forestry clear cuts fairly aggressively. When they cut, the Department of Forestry only gets $1, the county gets $2. And then there's herbicide application and reforestation and at a very dense level, and then in 40 years they look to cut again.
So I'm curious about the use of chemicals, herbicides, and can you talk a little bit about what kind of stuff do we spray on our forests?
Well, that's actually one of the problems is that there's not enough oversight to understand exactly what's being sprayed. It's typically a slurry of pesticide chemicals, a mixture that hasn't been tested as a mixture. So individual chemicals which have been approved, but mixes that may react in a way that is unpredictable. And it's generally applied aerially, which allows for wind to carry the pesticide in areas where maybe it's not intended to go. So water sources or even, you know, public residents or hospitals. The goal is to keep down the initial kind of undergrowth that would slow the initial growth of newly planted trees. Although I've been told that it may actually be more beneficial to allow that undergrowth to grow a little bit. And sure, the first few years of a tree's growth may be stunted, but the benefit that that understory has to the soil would actually, in the long term, improve the growth of the tree.
I'm trying to understand the benefit of the understory to the soil. You mean it would be actually adding nutrients, nitrogen and stuff?
Exactly. Yep. They're nitrogen-fixing plants, sword fern and scotch broom and that kind of thing, which actually, yeah, exactly. They enrich the nitrogen content in the soil. And again, I'm not a forester, I'm sure there are people who would not agree with that, but I've been told by a forest ecologist that that's the case.
Hmm. And that would be 200,000 acres of classic forest, but that same kind of approach probably would not be as prevalent on the private land.
No, on private land, it's the spraying is every acre that's cut is clear cut, and every acre that's clear cut is sprayed. So, you know, if you're driving up and down the coast and you see these kind of vast watersheds that are devoid of trees, you can assume that that area has been sprayed 2 to 3 times by pesticides.
Right. And obviously the pesticides can get into the surface water and impact property that's owned by the county and actually private citizens.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, more and more that's being found. It's not only affecting, you know, public health and the quality of drinking water, but it's affecting aquatic species health. And the other thing it's doing is raising the cost of treating that water. So, you know, a healthy, intact watershed is a natural water purifier, a filter. Mm-hmm. And it's probably the best one that's ever been invented. And when you take that filter out by clear cutting, and then you, in addition to that, you spray these harmful chemicals, then you need to treat that water in another way, and oftentimes that's more expensive. And who bears the burden of that water treatment? The public.
Yeah. So by water treatment, I'm assuming you're talking about potable water that comes in the pipes to our towns.
Yep, which requires chlorination or some other kind of filtration system.
Mm-hmm. I know in Astoria we have the slow sand filter that apparently is pretty effective without using too many chemicals.
Yeah, and I think other coastal communities have employed similar filters, but it's still a cost that would otherwise not be necessary.
But the so in other words, if we treated the entire forest as a water treatment system, then we wouldn't need to separately treat water that comes into the town.
That's my understanding. You may have to treat it for a few other things, but certainly not at the level that it's being treated now.
Huh. Okay. What are some of the other concerns that you have, Chris, regarding the management of our forests?
You know, currently there's no real long-term conservation areas on the landscape. There are areas that are set aside for, as I've mentioned several times, stream buffers and endangered species. But those are relatively small strips of land, and there's some larger contiguous patches where clear cutting isn't allowed, but there's still fairly aggressive thinning. But those patches have the potential to disappear from the landscape, kind of at the whim of the state forester. And so I see a real need for long-term conservation values that are mapped out, that the public knows about, and they have the certainty of being managed for conservation for the foreseeable future. And especially in Clatsop County, where there's no federal land, state forests are the only real opportunity for contiguous conservation areas. And that's not only important for watershed health and, you know, species of concern, but I think Oregonians really value the opportunity to go into these complex forest areas and go on hikes and see giant trees and, you know, open, really living, breathing forests. And especially in Clatsop County, we really don't have that opportunity.
Well, another thing that we really haven't talked about, but a well-managed forest would actually be affecting the health of the atmosphere, and that would be a global concern.
Absolutely. You mentioned earlier these are some of the fastest-growing forests in the world, and you know, as fast as a tree grows, that's how much carbon it's able to store. And you know, people say that when you log a tree, then you're still maintaining the carbon storage in whatever product that tree eventually makes. But studies have shown that really 90% of the carbon escapes a tree when it's logged and then manufactured into something. So the real effective way for forests to store carbon and mitigate climate change is by remaining forests and not being turned into pulp or furniture or paper. And, you know, the other thing that healthy forests do in kind of a microclimate region is they mitigate flood damage. They mitigate drought. You know, they keep our waters cold. So, you know, once you start opening up that other package of kind of inarticulate values to the climate and the micro region, then you're talking about a world of good that intact forests do that clear cuts don't do.
Right. It seems to me that it's critical that Oregonians kind of learn a little bit more about this whole situation, because globally, I mean, see climate change, for example, and increase in temperature of the oceans and all of that really could be impacted by our forests here in Clatsop County.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, not only on a global scale, but we're even seeing it in, you know, fish returns reflect forest health. You know, a number of these coastal communities are going to find rising ocean levels to be a problem in the not-so-distant future. And while, you know, the Clatsop State Forest in Clatsop County is a tiny, tiny postage stamp on the global map, it's critical in and of itself, but it's also emblematic of how we should be managing ecosystems around the world and around the country.
I understand. What kind of attempts are being made to educate people about these concerns?
Well, I think we're seeing a real push by citizens of Oregon to kind of grasp control of our forest management in Oregon. And I think that's due to some of these pesticide sprayings and the impact they've had on public health and coastal communities. But also just kind of a concerted effort by citizens and nonprofits to really bring to light what's going on these forests. And I think Oregon has this reputation of being a very green place, a very sustainable place. And in many ways that is true, but in forestry, we really lag behind. And I think there's a concerted effort to change that perception by changing the management. So there's a film that's been circulating the state for about 6 months now called Behind the Emerald Curtain, which was produced by Pacific Rivers, which really highlights kind of the problematic aspects of private forest management. Our group has been working for about 4 years to, again, shed light on state forest management problems. And there's other groups who are doing it farther south on the coast. So I think the impetus to educate Oregonians and kind of remove that veil from forest practices is probably more aggressive than ever, and I think the timing is perfect.
And your timing is perfect too, Chris, because we've got to bring this show to a halt. It's been really a wonderful conversation with Chris Smith, talking about the Clatsop State Forest and other concerns regarding the state forest. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.